Welcome to the Risk and Repeat podcast, episode number 11. I'm Rob Wright, editor of Search Security, and I'm here with my site editor, Peter Loschen. Peter.
Hi, Rob.
Thanks for joining us. And also a special guest, once again, third man in the booth, Aditya Gune, senior products editor at TechTarget. Aditya, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Rob. Glad to be here.
And since we went a little long in our last discussion about the HTTP proxy vulnerability and all that was going on with the responsible disclosure and discovery of that vulnerability and what it said about the general state of information security industry and how we discover and address vulnerabilities, we decided to sort of split that episode and tackle the ASN.1 vulnerability and all that's involved with that into its own discussion, because we went a little long there as well. So let's get into it, guys. Let's talk about ASN.1 and the issue with the I guess it's a critical flaw, Peter. And am I correct in describing it?
Okay.
This is a bit different than HTTP. Proxy.
Right.
I pulled that name off, although it took me like 10 minutes to
practice makes
to
perfect.
Sound it out. Yeah. But in the podcast, I'll cut it down to 5 minutes.
Okay.
So tell me a little bit about this. And
If you thought the HTTP proxy flow was
complicated
and technical.
Oh, I edited your story, so I know. I'm like, what's going on here?
Oh, I had to write it. And
no, it was a good story.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. But so ASN.1 is a specification for writing how your data is going to be handled by networks and telecommunications.
And
it
stands for?
Abstract Syntax Notation 1. And it came out of the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union.
Yes.
Okay. They've been around for a pretty long time, and
yes.
They've been doing these. They've had a lot more experience writing obtuse or opaque seeming specifications for things. So, okay, ASN.1.
I like that. That was very neutral and very diplomatic of you. Sorry, go ahead. So,
okay, ASN.1 as a specification for expressing how you're going to handle data,
yes,
in a communications network has also sort of spilled over to the TCP/IP world, the internet specifications and protocol specifications world. Anyway, telecommunications and networking companies from Accenture down to Vodafone, and I think there were 3 or 4 dozen companies that were listed as potentially being exposed because they used a compiler,
right,
an ASN.1 compiler called ASN1C, provided by a company.
It's very original.
Well, it's logical and
it's
rational.
There's no
so
mistaking what it does. So I mean,
that's right.
Good.
It's ASN1C is an ASN1 compiler from Objective Systems.
Sure.
And a researcher at a telecommunications-oriented outfit based in Buenos Aires, Argentina, was doing some research on something else, and they just happened to discover that this ASN1C compiler, which is used to take the specifications that you write in ASN.1,
mm-hmm,
and then be able to incorporate those into your code, into your binaries that you use for your product, for your telecommunications products. So companies like Sony, Siemens, Deutsche Telekom,
yep,
you know, on and on, AT&T,
big boys,
all like Google, Cisco, and so on. I think Microsoft is probably in there as well. But all of these companies who are customers of Objective Systems and use this product, theoretically and potentially, their compiled code could be subject to an attack based on this flaw. Now, so far, the only company that's responded to that's actually said, "Hey, yeah, we are vulnerable because we use this product in our telecommunications products," Qualcomm, and they do not believe that it's an exploitable vulnerability in their case, at least, because they have done the work to make sure that they're doing checks on data that comes in and out, that they follow the, because by following the protocols, the specifications for the ITU and telecom specifications, they're able to say, well, we coded to the specification, which forbids us to forward any packets that have the type of a crafted data container.
True.
That would be able to exploit this kind of thing. So while we don't think we're vulnerable, we are making sure that we're going to incorporate the fixes. So they've come out and said that they are that they're involved. Three so far companies have indicated that they're not affected by this,
and those are
HP Enterprise, Honeywell, and Siemens.
Yes, I believe they prefer to be known as Hewlett Packard Enterprise.
Yes, you're correct.
Remember, we got that note. It said HP Enterprise. That's a no go. That's a non-starter. So
okay,
I just want to.
Well, at least I didn't say HPE, because
that's even worse than them. I think
it probably is. But because I can never remember what that stands for.
Well.
So that's the. Now, at the same time, the vulnerability got a CVSS rating of 9.3, which is pretty bad.
That's bad.
That's
critical. And what is it? This basically allows if I'm correct, heap memory corruption attacks that could result in remote code execution. So it basically would allow for companies that are vulnerable, it could allow attackers to take control of telecommunication infrastructure and the mobile devices that run on their systems.
Correct.
That's bad.
It is. It seems pretty bad.
I would say you probably don't need to say seems. This is really bad. No, I know what you're saying.
So I just
you're trying to keep it level, and I'm ready to go off the deep end here.
That is correct.
Yes.
So that's a reasonable assessment of the situation. I do want to Scott Petrie, who's CEO at Authenticate, told us that score, the 9.3, assumes the worst case assessment. Well, that makes sense, but he puts it like this. He said, you can think of it as a 9.3 for those whose code is using the affected libraries for managing the memory heap. But it's not like Heartbleed, where any data that is intercepted could lead to the vulnerability. He said, the ability to execute the exploit relies on grabbing the right data from the right exposed system, which may turn out to be a small number. So the issue is that the potential vulnerability, it really depends very, very hugely on the situation. And it also, if you've got it compiled into a binary that's running on half a dozen huge devices that run the backbone of the internet, well, that's bad, because it's a very, very vulnerable. It's a bad place to have this kind of a thing.
Yeah, I hear you.
But at the same time, you're not likely to find many attackers. Well, the advanced the APTs maybe, but you're not going to find many ordinary attackers that have access to a device like this to play around with it and figure out that it's vulnerable.
True.
And I want to point out to another comment from the gentleman that reported the vulnerability in the first place. He did say
Ivan
Arce or Arce, from Argentina. While he did tell us that there's no easy way to automate the process of looking for this in your code.
I think I know where you're going with this next part.
Vendors will be able to quickly assess if they use ASN1C to generate code. They can check relatively easily to see if they need to check more deeply. So that's sort of a good thing. But another thing that he told me,
he said, just to back up there, yeah. he said. So source code analysis nor binary analysis produce, and I'm quoting him now, produce definitive proof that a given system is vulnerable. So it takes a fair amount of work to really dig into whether or not you're in trouble. It takes a fair amount of work to determine if that 9.3 score means it's a hypothetical and oh no, this is really bad.
Right. So companies would be vulnerable if their code can take encode data encoded in ASN.1 from an untrusted source like the internet or any network, and then use the code generated by ASN1C unmodified to parse it. They would not be vulnerable if they added explicit checks to the sanity checking on the input to constrain the size of the data received from untrusted sources, or to identify and discard malformed input, which is, this should be sort of best practice to check that kind of thing when you're coding, even if they use the tainted compiler, they wouldn't be subject to the flaws. So, it's one of these things where it's in the background, and I liked what Petrie told me at the end, which was that.
He dropped some knowledge.
He did drop some knowledge. It was a very good point that he made.
It was a sobering point, but
he said he speculated. He said, vendors respond. They respond to a flaw to the extent that it seems like it's a dangerous flaw.
Sure.
So shell shock, people were rushing out fixes, and Heartbleed, Petrie said, if you recall Heartbleed, anyone running the affected SSL libraries were by definition exposed, which is why the fix was released and adopted so quickly. Now, it does matter a lot.
We're journalists.
And we're also being a little glib, but objective systems, or I'm being glib, objective systems, They have a patch for it, so you can get a hot fix if you want it.
Yeah.
But they didn't push it out to everybody. They didn't insist on everybody taking it. They made it said, if you want it, you can have it.
Yeah.
The next revision of our code will incorporate that fix.
If you want it.
So
if you want to inoculate yourself against the potential super bug.
Yeah, but so Petrie said, the fact that they're not pushing it really hard suggests to him that it's maybe less broadly exploitable, so that they're not saying everybody run around and panic. They're saying, here's a fix if you want it, and the next patch.
That's very optimistic. Before I weigh in, Aditya, what do you feel like, to Peter's point, that companies probably do the proper checking of this, and even if they are using the tainted code, the vulnerable code?
Well, I have no idea. One would hope that they do.
One would hope.
But I mean, like with our other vulnerability, the HTT proxy. The good thing is that you have to line up a lot of balls for this to work, like Peter said. The bad thing, in my view, is that this sort of reaches across multiple areas of information security and IT, in the sense that communication systems are vulnerable to this. And as far as I know, and I kind of know because part of my work is to produce buyer's guides, and we're doing one on unified communication systems, security is a sort of an inherent or an assumed feature.
Yes.
A lot of people, when they're trying to buy these systems, they don't think of what specific security measures they should look for in a unified communication system. And the second thing is that, as far as I know, I think Peter, in your story you wrote about this, that this affects the simple network management protocol. So this has the potential to affect network management systems that manage mobile devices, branch offices, WANs, all sorts of stuff.
This is my panic face.
Sorry,
Peter. You and Petrie are telling me it's all good. That's an exaggeration. I'm trying to keep me calm, and I'm. But Well, I'll let you go. Your counter, Peter.
Let me just. I'm gonna shift the conversation back a few decades, because I really
old school.
This is totally old. Like, these are the old school, the, you know, the giants of among us. 1984, Ken Thompson, the person who created Unix,
right?
He won the Turing Award, and he gave a little talk, and it got printed up in the August 1984 Communications of the ACM. It's a paper called Reflections on Trusting Trust, and if you haven't seen it or read it or heard of it, it's worth looking up. Reflections on Trusting Trust. It's 3 pages. Of that, about almost 1 page is sort of fluff and editorializing on his part, but the key, and another page roughly, is code snippets. But I wanna start with his conclusion that he came to. You can't trust code that you did not totally create yourself. He describes in this paper how you could go about modifying the C compiler in such a way that you can have it Trojan the login program, so that when you log in for anybody, you can either log in with their password or you can log in with your secret password that you've hard-coded into the compiler. You can then take the compiler and recompile it in such a way that traces of what you've done are eliminated.
Oh, that's so nice. That sounds perfect for an advanced persistent threat group.
Well, okay, I'm going
to... You're supposed to talk me off the ledge.
Okay, I'm going to guess that...
He brought this up in 1984?
1984.
And what year is it? It's 2006. 1984, the year Terminator came out? The year we were introduced to Skynet, he's writing about this, and it takes us this long to figure out that this can be done?
The year George Orwell warned us about.
Well, it's also the year after War Games came out, if I
like the references. Applause.
Mistaken.
Respect.
Yes.
All around.
But the point is that he makes a very good point about trusting trust.
Sure.
Who do you trust to write the code? Who do you trust to write the compilers that compile the code that are written by somebody else? Who do you trust to write the compilers that compile the ASN1 source code into code that can be incorporated into the C compilers? Now, it's important that, you know, a lot of people who are very concerned about their cyber hygiene will do things like compile their own version of Linux after having read through all the source code.
Right.
I can't imagine anybody doing that anymore. It's like a billion. What is it? How many lines of source code are there in Linux?
Probably a billion, more than that.
All right. Well, even if it's a million,
it's
I don't have time.
Like,
who has time for
matrix
that?
In there.
It's right, but so the point is,
I don't code, so that's my only reference.
You know, even if you're doing, you're monitoring the source code that you're looking at, you still can't necessarily find this kind of a Trojan, just because of the nature of the beast.
Sure.
So, I'm sure that if you compiled a Trojan horse into a login routine, like Thompson described in 1984, I'm sure that that's not gonna fly in 2016. But we still find there are going to be artifacts of security artifacts that are in this whole supply chain of code development. So I urge everyone to read the paper. It's probably the most complicated 3-page academic paper I've ever seen.
You're not selling it quite well to me? You should read it, but it's... No, I'm kidding.
Well,
it's short, but very
thought-provoking.
Okay.
Yes. Well, not complicated, thought-provoking.
Yeah. It's going to be complicated for me. I'm a journalist. Well, I mean, I guess...
You're selling yourself short.
Thank you. Aditya, to your point about the telecommunications, like, okay, so when I was reading this about this vulnerability, I'm sitting there and I'm saying, oh, man, this is bad, because all you hear about with man-in-the-middle attacks, with internet and telecommunications infrastructure, is the ability to conduct large-scale attacks, you know, like what they refer to as a man in the state, where some, like a third party or the government comes in to telecommunications infrastructure and basically takes it over. And, you know, you read about what happened in Turkey with the attempted coup and how almost immediately the government starts shutting down, you know, major resources on the internet for people to communicate and get media out. And then you see something like this is possible, not just, you know, in one particular country, but potentially, many different countries. You're talking about global telecommunications infrastructure. Like that's really troubling. And I don't want to be like, I know I joked, you know, North Korea hackers, yeah. But it does concern me when I see something, like whenever I see a vulnerability that where someone says like, oh, it's very complicated. You have to line everything up. You have to know that they're using this, you know, specific type of technology or software or specification. You have to know how the target uses it. You have to know this, that, and the other thing. I immediately think to myself, well, isn't that what an APT group does? Isn't that what a nation state, you know, attacker does? Like they target, they look for, they say, we want to break critical infrastructure. We want to break telecommunication systems. We want to break financial systems. They target, they look for weaknesses. They pore over it. They research. They go back decades to look at how things are being used, and they poke and they poke and they poke, and that's all they do. You know, they're like the Terminator, you know, to go back to my earlier reference. But seriously, like that's what they're paid to do around the clock. And for us to sit here, I would like to believe what Petri said, but for me to sit here and say, oh, it's unlikely, I just, knowing what we know now about how dedicated and how sort of around the clock these APT groups and these nation state groups work, I'm finding it harder and harder to believe that things like this have gone unexploited. And it's great that it's out. It's another example of, in this case, it was an individual researcher who first disclosed it, but of companies coming in and saying, oh, this is something that needs to be resolved. And okay, objective systems, maybe not quite as urgent as other major flaws, but I guess that's good news. And maybe I should just focus on that and be less pessimistic. You're nodding.
Well,
yes.
I think.
ADT's shaking his head.
Knowing what I know about telephone companies and their practices, I would suspect that most telecommunications companies are more I don't want to say rigid or controlled, but I think they're a little bit more disciplined to follow coding discipline.
Sure.
And doing sure. You know, doing the right things with their code as opposed to being a cowboy, like a lot of, you know, a lot of the apps that people use that are in the cloud, it's like, who's writing that? Well, some of them are written by guys like you, me, Aditya. They write code.
People that don't know a lot about stuff.
Ordinary people.
I'm pointing at myself.
Well, okay, ordinary, but they're ordinary people that have taken the time to figure out how to code.
Sure.
They write up an app and they put it on the app store. And they sell it, and people use it, and maybe the people that wrote it go on to do something else, and they stop worrying about it. But there might be a flaw in there. So, with the telephone companies, the telephone company is running; they've got to be up six sigmas, you know, 99.99999. They take a lot more care over reviewing code than some of the other, you know, startups and the app writers and stuff.
But every organization probably has or has had disgruntled employees, disgruntled people on IT staff that know, that say, oh, you know, I discovered this and it needs to be resolved, and you know, nobody listens, and then they get laid off or they don't get a raise or something is done to make them disgruntled, to make them a potential insider threat. And who's to say that one rogue employee, one insider threat, in all the years that this has been around didn't say, oh, you know what? I'm going to put this in my back pocket. I'm going to sell it. I know it's a doomsday scenario, but that's the look. This is what I do. I sit over here and I'm a pessimist and I think of the worst possible case scenarios for things like this. And, you know, that's me. And DTF, you're smiling. So
I am, because, again, much to Peter's chagrin, I'm going to add that, yes, it's true. You know, the big communications companies and telephone companies ideally should be careful. And, you know, I'm sure they are. I'm pretty sure they don't just disregard vulnerabilities. But I'd also point out that I think almost all of their source code is closed source, proprietary. So we don't have the same level of transparency as we would with open source code, where we can, you know.
True, but the thing about the discipline of coding that a telephone company employs is that if they have an ITU protocol, like a SS7 or whatever protocols they're using, and they're coding it, they've got best practices. So if the protocol says do not accept any data frames that are larger than 1500 bytes, they code that in there and they check the data when it comes in, because that's the proper, you know, textbook style. Whereas if you're just a coder and you're looking at the, you know, you're not reading the protocol specification deeply to find out exactly how you're supposed to do it, those kind of vulnerabilities get magnified.
True.
But
I think I'm kind of left with a little bit of optimism about the fact that these have been discovered and they are being resolved and addressed, but more than a little pessimism and sort of concern about the potential that these have already been sort of used by very advanced attackers. I'm going to try not to dwell on that, but it's going to be hard, and I make no promises. So I guess that wraps this segment up on ASN1, ASN.1, and the potential of this critical flaw, how it's been addressed, and what's being done, and what could have been done with it by attackers. And thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks, you know, Peter Loschen, thank you as always for being the level-headed voice of reason. You are, sir. So
thank you for saying that.
Yes, thank you for writing those excellent stories too. And Aditya, thank you for your insight as well. I think you're kind of going middle of the road here between pessimism and optimism, which is good. You fit the third man in the booth role pretty good. So thank you.
Oh well, thank you.
Yeah. Robert, there you go.
Thank you for your, you know, entertaining meltdowns.
That's what I do here. That's my value add. And I'm Rob Wright for Search Security and the Risk and Repeat podcast, and we will see you next time.